Welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Amalia. And over here in the corner, we have our little Virgo queen. It's almost her birthday. Lilliput.
And today I am talking about, well, first off, a story from a book called Encounters with Aliens. This is compiled and edited by George W. Early on the side. So I was like, oh, maybe it's a bunch of reports. And that's just pretty much what I thought until I read it. And it's just a compilation of sci-fi stories. So this is just like a short little sci-fi story that ended up being really cool and leading me down some really fun rabbit holes.
I'm looking at the book, by the way, Encounters with Aliens, and that alien has a huge cranium.
This is one of the coolest covers ever. I was so excited when I found it. And yeah, I'll post a picture on Instagram so people can see. This is, I love it so much.
I am going to be talking about a ghost story that I found through newspapers.com.
Some old newspaper ghost stories, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. And we just saw the wonderful film Slaughterhouse. And it's, you know, it's a little indie horror pick. It was only in theaters for one day. I was like, we got to go. It's only in for one day. And the most important part to me was that the sloth is indeed animatronic.
Yeah.
If it was a CGI killer sloth, maybe I'd watch it at home. But it being an animatronic killer sloth, got to see it.
It was fun watching it at the theater we went to because all of us and the audience members were just cracking up all of the same things. And someone even wore a sloth, like, onesie outfit. So it was hilarious.
And we're pretty sure we know what Lilliput is going to be for Halloween this year.
Alpha, alpha, alpha.
It was definitely one of those movies where you were cheering and cracking up during the over-the-top kill scenes and stuff. But yeah, lots of practical effects, and it was just really funny and fun.
Very original. It was probably one of my favorite summer films.
Right on. Go out and support indie horror whenever you can, especially if it's a killer animatronic sloth.
And I came up with that really stupid slogan that made no sense. A slothing good time.
Oh, on Instagram. Something about like three claws up kind of post or something. And then she said it was a slothing good time. And I was like, what is that? Slaughtering good time, maybe? It's a great word.
Sloths, no.
Yeah. Yeah,
sloth. So Slaughterhouse was written by Bradley Fowler and Caddy Lanigan. Y'all did great.
I was reading an article on Bloody Disgusting. Interview with someone from the film, and I guess it was like already being kind of thought of back in like 2017-ish or so. And from the beginning, they had decided on the animatronic sloth and practical effects first. So thank you for that.
One of the user reviews on IMDb says, "Get slothed" as the headline. So we all went wild with the sloth. Sloth things.
And
for this.
What is that referencing? Like, what? Get slothed.
Once again,
maybe?
The sloths know, and that's all that counts.
Definitely check it out. And I've got something for you from a book I found at Goodwill called More News of the Weird. So this is under fire, as you can see, page 44. A Detroit man sued the city fire department for letting his apartment burn down while two firefighters who were supposed to be fighting the fire were fighting each other. Alan Ruprecht said that the first firefighter entered his burning apartment carrying a hose, but when he opened the nozzle, no water came out. The first firefighter got mad at the second firefighter for not turning on the water and began beating him over the head with his helmet. Meanwhile, the blaze destroyed the apartment. I thought you would enjoy that one.
I just wonder what was going on behind the scenes. Like, what had been festering for them to have a blow up.
Who knows? Yeah. And then I just opened it up to a random page. I just thought this was interesting. The Central Intelligence Agency once hired a magician as a consultant to a project on behavior to see if he could explain things people had a hard time trying to explain. That was in quotes. Until his death in 1970, he also helped to write a manual for agents in using sleight of hand and administering drugs to unsuspecting persons. The agency had also asked him to analyze the work of a mystic who the agency said had devised a system for sending and receiving telepathic messages anywhere in the world. I wish they would use some names, but it might be kind of fun to figure out who that was. Anyways, that's more news of the weird. I think we're ready to get into the episode now, huh?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
So I did the thing that I like to do, where I'm like, I don't know what to research next. So grab this book off the shelf because it's beautiful. Like I said, Encounters with Aliens, compiled and edited by George W. Early. And I flipped it. I smacked my finger down. And I ended up on the story called The Granta Sighting by Avram Davidson. So this is a short story. And in between, George makes little notes of kind of why he included the story. This one says, while many contactees have clearly profited considerably by shrewdly promoting their alleged experiences with visiting extraterrestrials, observers of the UFO scene have noted that there have been some seemingly guileless folk who have made no such attempts at money-making. Why then do they persist in telling their seemingly wild tales? Avram Davidson not only suggests a reason for the telling of the tale, but a reason for the nature of the tale itself. So I'll give you a little bit setting of the story, and then I'm going to just kind of grab little quotes from the story as well.
Okay.
So it is set at Emma and Walt Town's farmhouse, far from the city, in Pavoirs Bridge, New York. And they're poultry farmers. They are being visited by a group of UFO researchers known as the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Coordinators Corp, which is so wild because they even referred to UFOs as UAPs at one point. It's important to note that this story was initially published in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction in April of 1958. So I guess the term UAP isn't that new. So Emma and Walt are being visited by this group. There's several people in it, as well as a radio program host who goes by the name Long Tom. This is a direct reference to a real radio announcer named Long John Nebel, and we'll get into him a little more later. So the UAPCC and Long Tom start by addressing the audience because they're recording a radio program, which they call the party line, which is actually, I think, what Long John Nebel called his listeners and stuff, or his show. So they're addressing the party line about the fact that Emma and Walt are not commercializing this in any way. They didn't know any of these folks before their meetings, and they won't even take money for the snacks and drinks that they're offering. They're pretty excited that all these people are in their house. They're giving them sandwiches and tea and all these snacks. So they're there in reference to a sighting that took place on October 3rd, which was being called the October 3rd sighting or the Granta incident. And then we also find out that there was a piece of fabric or cloth that was left behind by their alien visitors that is defying analysis in the labs. So Long Tom asks Emma to express the sighting in her own words. And then the story does this really interesting thing where it pops in and out of what actually happened, kind of from Emma's brain, but also like a narrator kind of thing. And then what she's saying happened. So I'm just going to take chunks out of the tale, summarize them, and then have actual quotes as well. So first, we're going to go to the actual book for the initial sighting of the UFO, because it's really cool. About 5 o'clock, when the dark was falling, Emma first noticed the cloud. She called it to Tom's attention. It was a funny-looking cloud. For a long time, it didn't move, although the other clouds did. And then, as the bright reds of the sunset turned maroon, magenta, purple, the clouds slowly came down from the sky and hovered about 10 feet over the Townes' front yard. "Walt, there is something very funny about that cloud," said Emma. "I don't believe it's no cloud," Walt declared. "Listen to that noise, would you?" It came from the cloud thing, whatever it was, a rattling, muffled sort of noise, and an angry barking sort of noise. The air grew very dark. "Do you think we should put on the lights?" Emma said. Walt grunted, and the whatever it was came down with a lurching motion and hit the sod with a clunk. It was suddenly lit up by a ring of lights, which went out again almost at once, went on, went out. Then there was a long silence. A clatter, a rattle, and again, the barking sound. So Walt and Emma witness all this, and then, being the nice folks that they are, they go over to see if they're in trouble. And if they need help. I love that that's their first thing to do. It's like, oh, someone must be in trouble. It even says, Emma called, "Yoo-hoo, anything wrong?"
Yoo-hoo. Wait, where is this again?
New York.
Oh, okay.
Pavoir's Bridge, New York, on a very small farm that they mention the only people that visit is like the people that pick up the eggs. Because even the mailmen leave the packages and mail like down the road, down the hill.
Interesting.
So it's kind of that far out that they never get visitors. There was a slither and a clatter. The lights went on again in the thing, and there was now an opening in it and two figures in the opening. One of them stared forward. The other reached out a, was that an arm? But the first figure barked angrily and it drew back. And there was another sound now, a sort of yelping noise, as the figure walked toward the house, and the second figure followed it. "A man and his wife," said Emma. So the Townes are sweet as can be to the creatures, and they notice that they're wearing something resembling bloomers. And you said that's kind of like...
underwear.
It's like Victorian era, or is it like...
This is in the 50s?
I think the story is written in the 50s. It just says October 3rd. It doesn't say like the year the sighting was supposed to take place, but I'm imagining at least mid 50s because that's when Long John Neville was on the air.
Oh, so bloomers, full loose trousers gathered at the knee, formerly worn by women or athletics.
Okay. I looked up pictures and it kind of looked like clown pants almost is
like
what
clown
I would.
Pants almost it almost looks like a slip, like a Victorian slip to me. But interesting. Okay.
And it was really cold out, so they were saying like, come inside. Emma even says
trusting.
Huh?
They're trusting.
Yeah. Emma even says, "Why, you'll catch your death out there with no coats on. You're all blue." And then it says, actually it was sort of a blue green. But she didn't want to embarrass them.
These aliens stumbled upon the nicest people to interact with.
Mm-hmm. So they come inside, and that's when they realize. So there was the barking, and then there was also kind of like a yipping kind of different noise. And they realize that it's a little baby alien. So there's two, and then there's a little one.
Oh.
And she says, "My goodness, well, isn't it just the picture of its father?" Then they pull out a strange container. Then, seemingly through telepathic communication, they learn why they're there. "Why don't you know what she's saying, Walt?" Emma asked. Walt squirmed. "Seems like I do, but I know I couldn't hardly," he said. Emma was half indignant. "Why, you can too? She's saying the car broke down and I wonder if I might warm the baby's bottle?" "That's what she's saying." "Of course you may. You just come along in the kitchen." Walt scratched his ear, looked at the second figure, it looked at him. "Why, I guess I'd better go along back with you," Walt said, "and take a look at your engine. That was a bad rattle you got there." So they warm the baby's bottle, Walt fixes the ship, and they're super grateful, and they just take off. Emma said, "It's so lonely up here. We hardly ever have any visitors at all. Goodbye, goodbye now." And finally, the visitors closed the opening in their vehicle. Walt says, "Hope the umpus stays fixed in the hoop, Nanny." There's a burst of pyrotechnic colors, a rattling noise, and a volley of muffled barks. "It didn't," Walt said. "Hear him cussing?" The rattling ceased, the colors faded into a white mist. "Got it now. Look at those lights go round and round. There they go. Wherever it is they're going." They closed the door and Emma sighed. "It was nice having someone to visit with," she said. "Heaven only knows how long it'll be before anyone else comes here." Just a couple hours later, in fact. That night, the UAPCC and Joe Trowbridge, who's like the leader of it, I wonder if that's a real person as well, or like a real type of character, they show up to the house and ask if they had seen anything strange in the sky because there was reports of a flying saucer. They ask, and Walt is super honest. He's like, "Yeah, they were blue." And they're like, "Blue?" And he's like, "Well, kind of green." They're like, "Green?" And he's like, "Kind of a bluish green." which I loved that. They brought that back. What were they wearing? Well, they were kind of like bloomers. Bloomers? What did they want? Like, why were they here? And he's like, "Oh, they just needed to warm the baby bottle and fix the engine." Emma noticed that the looks on their faces, that they're not believing it at all. And she's really enjoying all these visitors. So she does what I would say under embellishes and tells them what they want to hear. "My husband is joking," she said, loudly and clearly. "Of course it wasn't like that." Joe turned to her. "Did you see it too, lady? What happened then? I mean, really happened. Tell us in your own words. What did they look like?" Emma considered for a moment. "They were very tall," she said. "They had on space suits. And their leader spoke to us. He looked just like us, only maybe his head was a bit bigger. He didn't have no hair. He didn't really speak English. It was more like telepathy. The people gathered around her closely, their eyes aglow, their faces eager. Go on, they said, go on. His name was Grunta. Grunta, the people breathed. And he said we shouldn't be afraid because he came in peace. Earth people, he said, we have observed you for a long time. And now we feel the time has come to make ourselves known to you." And then they go back, okay, to Long Tom's like, "Oh, that's amazing. That's incredible. Well, say about this piece of cloth-like substance. It's absorbent, it's soft, it doesn't burn, and it can't be analyzed. Now, about how big is this wonderful item, which Granta and his people left behind as a sample of their superior technology and peaceful intentions, and which continues to baffle scientists? About how big is it? Just tell us in your own words." Emma considered. Joe pursed his lips. Lou Del Bello, who's one of the UAPCC researchers, smiled and said, "Well, I've had the good fortune to see it," he said. "And speaking as the father of three, the best comparison of its size, which I could give you, I'd say it's just about as big as a diaper." What? He guffawed. Joe burst out laughing. And then it lists everyone else. They all were laughing. Emma and Walt looked nervously at each other, looked anxiously at their oh-so-very-welcome guests. But only for a moment. Then, reassured, they leaned back and joined in the merriment. It's such a good story.
Yeah,
it's wild. It's so funny. And it says a lot about the experiencer perspective and the researcher media perspective. To Emma and Walt, it was simple. These folks needed help, and they helped them. They were happy to help, and they had this really incredible experience. But it didn't fit what the researchers wanted it to be. It didn't fit what the media wanted it to be. Emma took it into her own hands and just repeated the same kind of tropes that she had heard many times before. We have observed you for a long time. We come in peace. We're wearing spacesuits. They have some crazy sounding name like Grunta.
Yeah. Always rural areas too.
Also the fact that the story that led me down the path of green mist, which was randomly found on the liminal earth map, also contained a barking cloud. And this story essentially contained a very different version of a barking cloud. I will remind you, I don't believe it's no cloud, Walt declared. Listen to that noise, would you? It came from the cloud thing, whatever it was, a rattling, muffled sort of noise, and an angry, barking sort of noise. And then you go a little later, which I didn't include earlier. Sounds like someone's cussing almost, somehow, Walt said. So these beings spoke in a garbled kind of barking language. And it was the father cussing because the engine was broken in the ship.
Wonder what the engine looked like.
Yeah, I like how it says something about the hoot nanny or something too.
Yeah.
But it looked like a cloud. Like I said, that random liminal earth story contained a barking kind of cloud. And then I randomly open a random page in this book, and it also essentially has some very different version of a barking cloud. And I find that kind of crazy. I find that really wild. So cool. Those kind of synchronicities just blow me away. So fun. So first off, Avram Davidson, the writer of the story. He was born on April 23rd, 1923 in Yonkers, New York.
Oh.
He was a fantasy, sci-fi, crime, and non-genre conforming writer. He served as a Navy hospital corpsman during World War II, and his writing began as a scholar of Talmudic. The Talmud is the central text of Judaism and the primary source of Jewish religious law and Jewish theology. In the 70s, he converted to something called Tenrikyo, which also probably butchering pronunciations here. But that's a newer Japanese religion that originated from the teachings of a 19th century woman named Nakayama Miki, or Miki, M-I-K-I, known to her followers as Oyasama. A lot of different beliefs for him. And he also traveled quite a bit. He lived in many different places, including Mexico, Belize, which at the time was known as British Honduras, later to San Francisco. He taught at the University of Texas at El Paso.
Oh, wow.
But do you know where he ended up?
Where?
Bremerton, Washington.
Shut up.
Yep. That's just so wild to me. Found this book in a random shop, flipped it to a random thing. And he passed away very nearby us. Passed away on May 8th, 1993 at the age of 70. There was a memorial service for him at Gasbrook Parks in Seattle.
What?
Yeah. I've just begun to dig into Avram's work, but I'm looking forward to starting with the anthology that this story comes from called Or All the Seas with Oysters. So he had tons of anthologies, tons of books. But I think he also wrote for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I love his writing style. The story's really funny.
Yeah.
I'll let you borrow it so you can actually read it, because you'll enjoy the way that it's written. It's just...
He gets, you know, country people down really good, especially kind of a secluded area. So that's fun. Also, it was kind of cute that the aliens in it.
It was a sweet story.
It was sweet. It wasn't like the aliens found the perfect people in it to talk to.
And the barking reminds me of like the Mars Attacks. Like, that's kind of how I was picturing the vocalizations. Lastly, Long John Nebel. Okay, the character in the story known as Long Tom is very much an ode to Long John Nebel, like the most obvious one ever. Even lists the same radio station he worked at for years called WOR, which was one of New York's leading stations. Long John Nebel was a precursor to folks like Art Bell, Coast to Coast Radio, I mean, all that stuff. Long John was one of the first. So from Wikipedia, in the mid-1950s until his death in 1978, Nebel was a hugely popular all-night radio host with millions of regular listeners and what Donald Bain described as a fanatically loyal following to his syndicated program, which dealt mainly with anomalous phenomena, UFOs, and other offbeat topics.
Mm-hmm.
I love the offbeat stuff. So Long John didn't get into radio until he was 43 years old in 1954. Before that, he was a freelance photographer, sidewalk salesman, and he ran a successful auction and consignment store in New Jersey. He was dubbed Long John the Gab and Gavel Man.
What a life.
The name Long because he was, I believe, 6'4".
Oh, wow.
His show was also known for introducing something known as the 7-second delay. Now, tape heads will find this interesting. But WOR was worried about some of Nebel's late night callers using profanity on air. Nebel used one of the first tape delay systems in radio, giving engineers a chance to edit any unacceptable language before it was broadcast. In 1956, engineer Russell Tinklepow invented the system that Nebel used. The deck was able to record on a loop of quarter-inch tape, and it would carry the tape around the deck to be played on the second set of heads. So it had like two kind of tape machines going. It would wrap into the next one where it would play. So it would like record and then it would play into the next one. That way, if someone cursed or something, they would have a chance to stop it before it actually played on air.
Oh.
Yeah. So very interesting that these kind of topics are what introduced something that was just like became standard, you know, in radio.
Yeah.
So in 1972, Long John married fashion model Candy Jones after a 1 month long courtship, who became his co-host almost immediately and continued in this role until his death. Shortly after their marriage, Nebel said he noted that Jones exhibited violent mood swings and at times seemed to display a different personality. Nebel called this the voice. Colin Bennett writes, a few weeks after their marriage, Jones did tell Nebel that she had worked for the FBI for some time, adding mysteriously that she might have to go out of town on occasion without giving a reason. This left Nebel wondering whether there was a connection between the other personality within Candy and the strange trips she said she had made for the FBI. Nebel began hypnotizing Jones and uncovered an alternate personality named Arlene. Under hypnosis, Jones related a lengthy, elaborate account of her being trained in a CIA mind control program, often at West Coast colleges and universities. Jones and Nebel eventually recorded hundreds of hours of these hypnotic sessions. And this is far too wild and interesting to not go into detail. So this is where I'm going to stop for now. I've always been interested in MK Ultra and CIA mind control experiments, but I've always been timid and kind of scared to go down that rabbit hole. I mean, I'm an impressionable young man, and I don't know what I'm going to find. But it's time. My randomization synchronicity technique has led me here, and I must follow.
Bored the other week, and I looked up ghost sightings prior to the 1920s, and I found really fascinating stories that I've actually never heard of before. I know I say that a lot.
There's too many things to know all of it.
So I wanted to do kind of like a bunch of the different stories that I found, but I got caught up on one of them. Because I found some things that were too wild not just to focus solely on. So here is one of them. On April 13th, 1878, the Boston Globe printed a story about a female ghost who stopped a railroad train. It stated that an engineer on a freight train in the Missouri, Kansas, and Topeka reported seeing a ghost on numerous occasions. It was on the track of railroad between Nevada and Ellis, Missouri, and it was near where the body of a woman was found the prior year. The engineer recalled seeing a figure of a woman get on the track before the train and walk ahead of it a short distance and then leave. Nothing could be seen after the ghost left the tracks, and her figure was so clear on a different sighting that he hit the brakes to stop the train, but once the train stopped, there was nothing there. So the story caused a big commotion, and many locals said they would be on the watch for the ghost woman. Now, I couldn't find too much about the woman on newspapers.com, but I looked up train track ghost of Ellis, Missouri, and I found the strangest connection. The ghost sighting is part of an Unsolved Mysteries episode.
Here we go.
So I think this story is from around 1990 when it aired on Unsolved Mysteries. I could not find an exact episode number.
It is season 3, episode 14, originally aired on December 19th, 1990. Looks like it's free on YouTube and Tubi. Okay, back to Amelia.
But the story is intertwined with a missing person story. The missing person was a woman named Conradina Olson, who went missing in 1910, and her granddaughter, Geneva Fuchser, was hoping to find answers about her disappearance. So in 1910, Conradina boarded a train in Brookfield, Wisconsin, and told her family she was heading to Milwaukee for a doctor's appointment. She asked her oldest son, Edwin, if he'd like to join her, and he declined, and this was a decision that haunted him for the rest of his life. Conradina never returned from her journey, and there was no answers as to where she had gone and what happened to her. In 1983, Edwin's daughter, Geneva, set out to find answers to the mystery that plagued her father's life. She found that her grandmother's marriage to her grandfather was not exactly a happy one, and that her grandfather may have been abusive. So it kind of went cold from there, but then in 1985, Geneva and her husband were running a gift shop. And on a random day in September, a woman came into her shop, and Geneva felt there was something different about the woman. She said she kind of watched her for a while in the shop, but she doesn't like to bug customers too much. And the woman...
Empty your pockets.
The woman eventually came up to the front and told Geneva that she was a psychic and that she knew that she had questions about her grandmother.
Mm.
And she told her that she would need something that was her grandmother's. So she grabbed her grandmother's marriage license and a wedding photo. And then the psychic used it, and she told her that she could see Conradina being beaten, and that she mentioned the name Ellis, and she mentioned that her grandmother was in an unmarked grave. She told her to expect a letter from an unknown source. So a couple weeks went by, and then Geneva received old letters and pictures in the mail from Conradina's nieces and nephews. The items were from the 1800s, and the letters spoke of trouble with her marriage. Geneva sent word to the Midwestern newspaper about her story, and they responded with information about the unmarked grave of a woman in the town of Ellis, Missouri. The woman was unknown and found murdered near the railroad tracks. Geneva wondered if this woman was in fact her missing grandmother, but the timeline does not add up, because the woman found murdered appeared to be in her 20s and was found in 1877, and when Conradina disappeared, she was 38 and it was 1910. She wondered if maybe there was an unmarked grave near that one that could have been her grandmother's. And I guess she even visited the site and she had her photo taken near it and there was like a weird apparition in it. And she went back on a separate occasion and same thing. Same thing was in the photo.
Did you see the photo?
No.
We got to find that photo.
Yeah, it might be in the episode, I bet.
Oh, we're going to find that episode.
I looked into the unmarked grave that they mentioned, and I found that on April 21st, 1877, an unknown woman was found murdered in a field alongside the Katy Railroad tracks near Ellis, Missouri. Her body was decomposed and may have been there for several weeks. She was beaten and then shot through the chest, and there was nothing to identify her or reveal where she had come from, and she was believed to be around the age of 20. And according to local legend, the woman was seen getting off the train at Ellis near Highway 43. She was fashionably dressed and seen crying and arguing with a man. And witnesses reported they thought they were a couple having a disagreement and that they stormed east down the tracks. The man was later seen returning to the station alone, and he boarded another train and left town. Now, then they found her body alongside those train tracks where they were near, and railroad workers buried her in a field a few yards from where she was found. And since the murder, the woman's grave has been maintained by railroad workers and adorned with flowers every Memorial Day. So I wanted to find more newspaper articles about this, because this, what I just read was kind of just according to local legend. But there's an article, May 4th, 1877. It was published by the State Journal, and they said that it was a man named Mr. Fudge who was looking after his stock near the railroad tracks in Ellis, Missouri, when he found the body of a woman. Now, the body had been covered with prairie grass that the killer had cut to conceal her body, and Mr. Fudge notified neighbors, and they used pitchforks to retrieve the body and bury her, but then the coroner had to dig her up again to examine her. And he found, you know, that she had been shot and beat, but she had in her pocket of her dress was a map for the Missouri Pacific Railroad. Before her body was found, a woman's shawl and a carpet bag with a pocket mirror and a broken earring was found on the railroad tracks. And it's possible that these could have belonged to her. Now, the area where she was killed was in view of 12 houses. So they think that she would have had to have been killed at night for the killer to go unnoticed. And there are some theories that the woman may have been somebody called Lula King from Indiana. And I was unable to find any information on a Lula King from Indiana. But I did find a newspaper clipping from the Chattanooga Daily Times, which was a marriage license from June 25th, 1885. And it simply stated that an Alfred Taylor married a Lula King. Now, I'm not saying that these are the couple, but it's just an odd coincidence that I could only find ones prior to 1887 of a Lula King. Now, the State Journal, the full newspaper clipping is on newspapers.com. And the article was titled, "Who Was the Woman and What Was the Motive?" They do have a theory that maybe, because there was all those houses nearby, maybe she was not killed there, but killed somewhere on the train and then just put out there and left. Mm. That was their theory back then, and they never solved it. So it's interesting that the ghost sighting started a year after the woman's body was found. And I'm still not sure why the Midwestern newspaper, it's interesting that they did, but I don't know why they told her about the unmarked grave of the woman, just because the timelines don't add up. I kind of felt like it was a little bit of like false hope almost that they could have solved it, because I think that she wondered for a while if it could have been her grandmother and if maybe back then they just didn't report correctly on the dates. But it's probably disappointing for the family.
Yeah, it is really interesting that a year after they started seeing these apparitions of a lady on the train tracks, but it doesn't sound like it was like a ghost story that continued.
No.
Or at least not reported.
Yeah, I haven't found any reports in modern day. This was all just from 1878. So I don't know what happened. Maybe the railroad just quit going through there. But yeah.
Maybe it was just very much on everyone's mind kind of at that time as well. Yeah. Isn't it wild how one thing can lead you down such a rabbit hole?
Yeah.
A little short story leads me to CIA mind control, and an innocent-sounding little ghost sighting by a train turned into a true crime mystery that was also featured on Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
All right, I'm looking forward to more ghost stories from you because spooky season's upon us.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're my favorite. So this is a random story from Liminal Earth from December 14th, 2020. And it's out of Washington.
Ooh.
Near Carnation.
Ooh, very cool.
It says, around midnight, I was picked up by my friend, and while we're leaving the area, we both saw lights floating a little higher than the trees to the side of them, but were out of sight too quickly to capture. And it was just titled, Mystery Lights, Classic UFO.
Very cool. Maybe we'll get lucky and we'll see something like that today. I want to see some mystery lights. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. You can find all of our links at anomalouswaves.com or follow us on Instagram at Anomalous Waves. You can message us directly through the link tree, through Instagram, or you can email us at anomalouswaves@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Your stories, your feedback, ideas for future episodes, whatever. There are tons of ways to support the show, including joining the Strange Pals Club. You can do that at patreon.com/anomalouswaves. You can rate us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. But the easiest way to support the show is by telling someone about it.
Tell a murderous animatronic three-toed sloth.
Tell some lonely poultry farmers.
Tell a railroad engineer.
Tell some fistfighting firefighters.
Tell my AI on Snapchat.
Tell a barking cloud.
Tell a newspaper editor.
Most of all, just tell anyone who likes anything weird. Okay, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.